Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
Well, there's a gentleman from New Orleans, Louisiana. There's controversy now in the wake of the lifting of the restrictions on European airspace that stranded so many in the past week. Some are still stranded. Hello to all of you stranded listening on Strandcom. The controversy, I say, about whether the European aviation authorities were correct in closing the airspace of the continent in the wake or in the expectation, actually, of the ash cloud. I said ash, stemming from the volcano in Iceland. And it's, you know, from this distance and even maybe from a closer distance, it's if you let the planes fly and something bad happens to one, you know what's going to happen then. So, of course, people are going to be saying, you know, really, I know the airlines are going to lose money, but it's better than my hiney. So, of course, it ended up the way it did. The one thing that I think we all agree on, well, there's no controversy about how to pronounce the name of the volcano.
Underneath the Eyjafjallajökull Glacier.
The eruption at the Eyjafjallajökull Glacier was...
The volcano underneath the Eyjafjallajökull Glacier.
According to reports, the three eruptions of Eyjafjallajökull on record have...
Eruption under the Eyjafjallajökull Glacier.
Iceland's Eyjafjallajökull volcano roared back into life just weeks after it erupted for the first time in nearly 200...
We can't even agree on how to pronounce glacier. How do you expect this to... Ladies and gentlemen, F is for FEMA. No, actually not, really. It's not a FEMA story. It's a people story. You know, in the wake of the flooding of New Orleans, one heard a lot of folks saying, well, why don't y'all just move? Really, just move. Because, you know, why should we pay to rebuild? It's a bad place. Why would we pay to rebuild to put you back there? Then we see this story. Larry Fries in Chelsea, Iowa, and his neighbors are not interested in being bought out of their homes by the government for the chance to start over on higher ground. They were flooded out, and a large swath of Iowa was flooded out underwater as the overflowing Otter Creek lapped at his garage door. I say they're not interested in being bought out for the chance to start over on higher ground. Neither do handfuls of other flood-prone Midwest towns caught in cycle of flood and rebuild. I love this town too much to leave, the 69-year-old tavern owner said. Many mitigation experts say such buyouts are the most cost-effective way of fighting floods in the most at-risk areas. The government buys houses in these areas and tears them down, replacing them with green space parks or wildlife refuges. But such buyouts are voluntary, and despite the clear benefits they brought some flood-beleaguered towns that opted in, many communities refuse to budge. In the Midwest, ladies and gentlemen. So, not just New Orleans. We're not number one. And this is a good thing. It's a good thing not to be number one on this. A new report says Canadian companies in the Great Lakes Basin are releasing more cancer-causing pollutants into the air than American companies. Go Canada. The report says Canadian facilities emit almost three times more carcinogens per facility than their U.S. counterparts. Well, that's just they're more efficient. The Canadian Environmental Law Association says the difference in emissions is even more remarkable, considering there are far fewer Canadian than American facilities reporting. I say it's Canadian efficiency in action. And this, ladies and gentlemen, should come as a relief to us all. The Defense Department says it plans to improve oversight of contractors in Afghanistan and Iraq by hiring more contracting specialists and providing additional training for government employees who supervise the work performed by... Why don't we just do the work ourselves? Now we have to hire more people to private contractors to supervise the private contractors we have to supervise to not have our own... By our own, I mean the government's own people. We are the government. Sorry, Glenn. Pentagon officials told a congressionally appointed panel monitoring federal spending on war zone contracts that years of attrition in the department's acquisition workforce have hampered oversight, particularly as defense budgets have skyrocketed. The Army's contracting workforce is only 55% of what it was in the mid-90s, but the dollar value of contracts overseas has jumped from $11 billion to $165 billion. The Army is reversing this 15-year steady decline in its workforce, says the principal military deputy to the Assistant Secretary of the Army for Acquisition, Logistics, and Technology, which tells you all you need to know about that. We project recovery to the proper level of staffing will take at least 10 years. So contractors, have at it, baby. You got 10. Hello, welcome to the show. Take the whole decade, won't you?
Made my journey hard and slow. I turned to worldly pleasures, but I only found pain and woe. I'm back on the road to the city, and I'll never turn back.
From the edge of Lake Pontchartrain in New Orleans, Louisiana, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this. I'm pointing to this one, this edition of the show. And now, news from outside the bubble. Well, part of this story, of course, was inside the bubble. This is from the BBC. Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri Maliki and his U.S. And U.S. officials say two leaders of al-Qaeda in Iraq were killed early this week in a joint Iraqi-U.S. operation. You heard that story, right? Maliki said on national TV that Iraqi al-Qaeda leader Abu Ayyub al-Masri and Abu Omar al-Baghdadi, who led an affiliated group, were dead. And Vice President Joe Biden said their deaths were potentially devastating blows to al-Qaeda in Iraq. Okay, now here's the part you maybe hadn't heard. According to the BBC, there have been several previous official reports that both militants had been captured or killed, which have turned out to be untrue. And, the BBC adds, al-Baghdadi was a nom de guerre for the shadowy leader of the group, although some U.S. commanders had previously cast doubt on whether he even existed. That is potentially lethal. Devastating. How will al-Qaeda recover from the death of a guy who never existed? News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now news of AFPAC. AFPAC! This is such... Man, it makes me proud to be part of this whole mission. Footage of Taliban fighters swarming a former U.S. military mountaintop base in Afghanistan has been aired on a major satellite TV station just days after American forces withdrew from the Karangal Valley. I'm just thinking about it. Which has seen some of the toughest fighting in the Afghan war. Armed insurgents can be seen overrunning the area. The video, which was shown on Al Jazeera, will be seen as a morale boost for Taliban fighters, according to British newspaper The Daily Mail, even though the U.S. insists the area has no strategic value. A mountaintop base, ladies and gentlemen, has no strategic value. A base that we fought to defend for 5 years. That must make the guys who spent the 5 years there feel good. American soldiers spent 5 years defending the base, which the U.S. dubbed the Valley of Death after 42 servicemen were killed in battle there. Taliban fighters said they wanted to see how the troops lived and collected the abandoned fuel and ammunition, which they say they will use against the U.S. The footage shows men walking through the former base, which was strewn with litter and empty bottles. Yeah, that was our base. That sounds like us. And sitting atop, they were, sandbag gun positions overlooking the steep hillsides and craggy landscape of no strategic value. Locals visited the site. One who was interviewed by Al Jazeera said, quote, "We don't want Americans, we don't want Germans or any other foreigner. We don't want foreigners, we want peace." A U.S. military spokesman said ammunition had been evacuated and the fuel handed over to local residents. Another man, identified by Al Jazeera as a local Taliban commander, said the militants intended to use the base as a base for attacks on U.S. forces. But they're going to have to clean up the empty bottles first, and that's going to take days. Also in news of AFPAC, Asia Times reports that in addition to being the world's leading producer of opium, Afghanistan has now become the largest producer of hashish. According to the first ever cannabis survey released by the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime, you know D.C., the U.S. invasion is reportedly behind the new record. The Afghanistan Cannabis Survey reveals there's large-scale marijuana cultivation in half of the country's provinces, lower than opium cultivation in terms of acreage covered. Afghanistan's crop yield is so high at 145 kilograms of resin per hectare. That's the way I like to buy my dope, in resins per hectare, that it overtakes other leading producers like Morocco, where cannabis covers a larger land area but whose yield is higher. That's Afghan efficiency at work, ladies and gentlemen. Afghanistan produces 1,500 to 3,500 tons of hashish annually. The industry involves 40,000 households. The amount paid to farmers is estimated about $40 to $95 million yearly. That's a big range, babe. Hashish is the most commonly used drug in Afghanistan, where more than 500,000 users are mostly men. Marijuana, on the other hand, is a minor product in Afghanistan compared with hashish. So there you go. And by the way, of course, yes, it is the, it is rooted in the, I believe, Arabic word for assassin. Hashashin. So, no strategic value to the hilltop base, but plenty of hashish. Now, ladies and gentlemen, news about the financial mess that we're still in. And, you know, amid all the sunnier reports of recent days, one little factoid flashes back to my memory. Well, it's flash memory over and over again, which is stories that you would see maybe 3, 4, 5 weeks ago that said on the business pages that said, well, there's still this commercial real estate bubble that's yet to burst. And then, of course, that went away. And, oh, you know, GM's coming back. And I'm just thinking, yeah, but didn't you just say there's still this commercial real estate bubble that's yet, and when the residential real estate bubble burst, that wasn't a good thing, was it? Anyway, during the buildup to the financial crisis, major rating agencies, you know this, Moody's and Standard & Poor's, gave AAA ratings to those packages of crappy mortgages. Well, it turns out they were understaffed, didn't have enough data about the mortgage securities they were rating, and were pressured by each other and investment bankers to issue overly rosy ratings. That's according to Senator Carl Levin, chairman of the Senate committee investigating the ratings agencies. He's blaming them for being pressured by their competitors. Competition made them do it. So I'm okay. Is it a good thing now, competition, or is it a bad thing? I'm confused. And the only way to deal with that confusion is the apologies of the week. We're so sorry. McAfee Incorporated apologized late this week for crippling thousands of customers' computers with a flawed update the day before. I want to apologize on behalf of McAfee and say that we're extremely sorry for any impact the faulty signature update file may have caused you and your organization, said the executive vice president of support and customer service in a post to the company's blog. It was the first apology by a McAfee executive for the fiasco, which started in the middle of the week when an antivirus signature update wrongly quarantined a critical Windows system file after identifying it as a low-threat virus. I said Windows. The British Foreign Office has apologized for a, quote, foolish, unquote, document which suggested the Pope's upcoming UK visit could be marked by the launch of Benedict-branded condoms. The junior civil servant responsible for the document has been put on other duties. Called The Ideal Visit Would See, ... the paper suggested the Pope be invited to open an abortion clinic and bless a gay marriage during his visit this coming September. The Foreign Office stressed that the paper, which resulted from a brainstorm, did not reflect the official views of the Labour Party government. The document was obtained by the Sunday Telegraph newspaper. The UK's ambassador to the Vatican, Francis Campbell, met with senior officials of the Vatican to express regret on behalf of the government. Foreign Secretary David Miliband is said to have been appalled by the contents. The paper was attached as one of three background documents to a memo dated March 5 inviting officials to attend a meeting to discuss themes for the Pope's visit. It suggested Benedict the 16th could show his hard line on the sensitive issue of child abuse allegations against Roman Catholic priests by sacking dodgy bishops and launching a helpline for abused children. It went on to propose the Pope could apologize for the Spanish Armada. I think they mean the Inquisition, don't they? Or sing a song with the Queen for charity. The official responsible said in a cover note, please protect, these should not be shared externally. An investigation has been launched. The Foreign Office spokesperson said the department was deeply sorry for any offense the document had caused. Many of the ideas in the document are clearly ill-judged, naive, and disrespectful, the document said, the apology said. Can they apologize any, can they be any more apologetic? An American soldier who took part in an attack in which 12 people, including a Reuters journalist, were killed and two children injured, has written an emotional apology to the victims' families in Iraq. Ethan McCord wrote, "The acts depicted in the video, released earlier this month by WikiLeaks, are everyday occurrences of this war." Apology is also signed by Josh Stieber, another former soldier from the same unit. "We humbly ask you what we can do to begin to repair the damage we caused," he writes. The release of the video embarrassed the Pentagon and prompted indignation. McCord's comments are likely to cause further disquiet. He claims he was so distressed by what he had witnessed that day, he asked to see a counselor, but was told by a superior, quote, "Don't be a pussy," unquote. Father Owen Kearns, the publisher of the National Catholic Register, has issued an apology for his energetic defense of the late Father Marcial Maciel. Father Kearns, who's regularly acted as a spokesman for the Legion of Christ, also apologized for his attacks against the critics of Maciel, the order's founder. "They didn't get everything about the Legion right, but they were fundamentally correct about Father Maciel's sexual abuse, and I ask forgiveness," says Father Kearns. He said he defended Father Maciel because he was convinced the charges against him were false. Having learned that, in fact, many of the charges were accurate, he felt compelled to apologize. In a message addressed to sex abuse victims, he said, "I'm sorry for what our founder did to you. I'm sorry for adding to your burden with my own defense of him and my accusations against you. I'm sorry for being unable to believe you earlier," unquote. I think he's sorry. And on the same subject, for the first time in history, Chile's Conference of Catholic Bishops apologized for sexual abuses committed by religious leaders in a document released this week. The bishops acknowledged there have been 20 accusations against priests for sexual abuse filed in the country's courts in recent years. Quote, "There is no place in the priesthood for those who abuse minors," says Bishop Alejandro Goic. "And there is no circumstance which justifies this crime. To the people directly affected and to the communities in Chile which have seen in any priest the cause for scandal, we apologize. We urge you to communicate any violations to us. It is completely our commitment to relentlessly expose events like these so that extremely serious crimes are not repeated." Goic did stand firm in his support of the Pope and celibacy. Quote, "To link celibacy to pedophilia is an error. Celibacy is not only a gift that God gives to those of us who are priests. It's other things, too." The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. In related news of the godly, a Belgian bishop has confessed to molest. It's a thing. It's a fad. It's big. A Belgian bishop has confessed to molesting a boy, becoming the first high-ranking prelate to be directly implicated in child sex abuse since the outbreak of the global scandal. Shortly after the Vatican announced the Pope had accepted his resignation, Roger Vangelui, the bishop of the Flemish city of Bruges, beautiful city, said that before he took over his diocese and for a short time afterwards, "I sexually abused a young boy close to me." He didn't have to reach out. See, that's the advantage. In a letter read to a press conference, the 73-year-old prelate, who was not present at the press conference, said what he had done more than 25 years ago marked the victim forever. "This wound does not heal, neither for me nor for the victim," he said. Maybe list the victim first next time, babe. Vangelui was consecrated a bishop in 1985, said he had several times begged for the forgiveness of the victim and the family, apparently to no avail. The head of the Belgian Church and Archbishop of Brussels, André Joseph Leonard, acknowledged the affair would have a painful effect on Belgian Catholics. "We are aware of the crisis of conscience that the confidence that this is going to engender in a number of people," he said. And planned as a solemn event, a chance to experience the sacred liturgical roots of Catholic tradition at one of the country's most prominent churches, an elaborate Latin mass scheduled for this weekend at the Basilica of the National Shrine in Washington has been dragged into the clergy abuse scandal. The former Vatican official invited to lead the mass, Cardinal Dario Castrillon Hoyos of Colombia, once praised a French bishop for not telling police about a priest who had sexually assaulted children. News of the godly, ladies and gentlemen. Now, it's clean, it's safe, it's cheap, it's too clean to meter. The owners of Vermont Yankee nuclear plant say an internal investigation has concluded that none of its representatives intentionally misled the state of Vermont about the presence of underground piping that could carry radioactive material. In a 114-page report, look at all those pages. Entergy says its personnel did give incomplete answers to questions posed by the State Board of Public Service and should have corrected them later, but that their lobbyists and others never tried to mislead. It was just, I guess, a happy accident. And because there aren't enough nuclear plants in the world, we know that. Saudi Arabia last week has announced the establishment of a renewable energy complex, confirming the country's interest in nuclear energy. The King Abdullah City for Nuclear and Renewable Energy will, according to a royal decree, be tasked with the research and application of nuclear technology and oversee all aspects of a nuclear power industry. Analysts say politics may have played a major role in the Saudi decision to focus on nuclear technology. The kingdom's leaders feel increasingly threatened by the specter of a nuclear Iran. This report, by the way, from the Jerusalem Post, which doesn't mention another nuclear country Saudi Arabia might be concerned with. It's clean, it's cheap. Just for fun, let's meter it.
Fruta de Conde, sua casca é romance. Muito boinha você, viu, laranjinha doce, dulcíssima pitomba jura, amargura no caroço. Goiaba quase de vez, mamoeiro dá um leite que fel, pitanga do céu, amor de maçã, debaixo do frio. Já manga, espada, inchada. Eu sou do mato, brinquei com maturi. Vou ficando por aqui nas costas da madrugada. Podendo o mato, fruto do ato, ligado à resina de cajá. Manga, espada, inchada. Eu sou do mato, brinquei com maturi. Vou ficando por aqui, meu bem, me abraça. E a lua quer me dizer.
real can reality TV yet? Ask Larry King and some schnauzers.
Got to be Inside Extra Access tonight for the end of April 2010. And I'm Pat Mungo reporting tonight from the Red Carpet Warehouse.
All this week, we're at RealCon 2010, reality TV's own convention. Reality has explored and exploited the private lives of celebrities from Danny Bonaduce to Ozzy Osbourne. But if one of the major producers at this event has his way, reality is taking itself to the next level. The King's Suite.
I get home from shooting the last episode of Hip Hop Wives.
Trey Compton produces more reality shows than a 16-year-old in traction could watch.
I hop on the internet and bang, I'm reading about Larry King and the thing with the sister and the Little League coach, and my head's exploding, and I'm on to the network and a freaking nano.
Ever since we branded Parents Informational Television Service as The Pits, I've been looking for something that's pure sizzle to act as, if you will, the flaming centerpiece of the network. That and some cheap mid-morning fill.
Donnie Perignon is the network's in-house programming guru.
Trey comes to me with King, the wife, the coach, the sister. I'm seeing four very strong characters. Most shows you're lucky you got one. So I'm thinking, how did I suddenly wake up and win the lottery? But, you know, sometimes you're just sitting right in the big, fat, sweet spot of the zeitgeist.
Of course, Sean's a performer. She's done Vegas with Larry. The coach is a natural, great with kids. The sister we're working with, and Larry. Larry is Larry.
And it's them, Nate and Al's. Johnny Pastrami. And then go f*** yourself. I'm not doing your f***ing show. That's a pickle.
He realizes that this program could not just revive or jumpstart or give CPR to his TV career. It could put a freaking IED up its butt. And, you know, he's also, like all of us, a very private person.
So I say to her, how do you think they got this way?
When we were playing Vegas, he was going to have me on the TV show for the full hour, but he could only give me about 10 minutes. As usual.
Shooting has already begun. Larry King's lawyers have already threatened to sue. The sister has hired a press agent. The coach is teaching his team the infield fly rule. And hopes at the Pits Network are sky high.
It's got the wow factor. It's got the how factor. It's got all the factors.
A King's Ransom debuts just in time for May sweeps.
Also in attendance at RealCon 2010 is reality producer Ron Zest. He went straight from playing the grunge kid on the short-lived That 90s Show to producing reality shows for everything from Spike to Animal Planet. Now he's found the best of both worlds.
We did 2 seasons of World Series of Midget Poker for Spike, and I've also done the Real Dogs of Marley and Me for Animal Planet. So we're at the office one day thinking, what combines the male appeal of poker with a female appeal of dogs? Because, you know, that's where the whole industry wants to be. I'm not ashamed to say that the idea came to me like one of those things came to Mozart, you know, just a flash. The World Series of Poker Playing Dogs.
But just how do you get dogs to play competitive poker on television?
Well, I mean, I'm not going to kid anyone. This is a scripted series of events, which, you know, I don't want to say the Midget Poker World Series was rigged, but everything in reality TV is scripted. I mean, I'm not ad-libbing with you right here, right now. No, a world-class trainer, a Caesar Milan, ideally a young Caesar Milan, trains our dogs. They represent their breeds. Winning breed gets the golden bone. It's fun. There's a charity thing maybe in it as well. We shoot it just like a regular TV poker championship. So there's drama. There's humor because it's dogs. And, you know, damn it if you can watch the first show and not find yourself rooting for Charlie the Labradoodle.
Can't tell you if Charlie wins, but Spike and Animal Planet may be planning to simulcast the World Series of Poker Playing Dogs later this year. And you can bet on it. Or at least your dachshund can.
That's got to wrap it for today. But Inside Extra Access tonight comes rocketing back tomorrow with the results of our latest IEAT poll.
We asked who was your favorite Twittering celebrity, and the results will have you using more than 140 characters.
Till then, I'm Mike DeVere.
And I'm Pat Mungo. So long from Culver City.
this 9-pound hammer is a little too heavy for my size. Hey, for my size. I'm going on the mountain, going up there to see my baby. I don't think I'll be back. No, not coming back this way. Hey, roll on, buddy. Don't you go so slow. Ah, how can I roll? My wheels, they don't glow. Ah, roll on, buddy. For the Lord of hosts. Ah, how can I roll? My wheels, they won't. It's a long way to hazard, just to get a little groove, yeah. Just to get a little groove. Hey, when I die, I want my tombstone made of number 9 coal, yeah. Make it a number 9 coal. They just won't go. Now this 9-pound hammer, just a little bit too heavy. Ah, for my size. Hey, 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 for my size. I'm going on the mountain, going up there to see my baby. And I don't think I'll be coming back. No, no, not coming back this way. Don't go, it's a 9-pound hammer.
This is Le Show, and ladies and gentlemen, an airport as airport security employees scan baggage for a large variety of banned items, they may miss a deadly box cutter if they find a water bottle first. According to new research at Duke University, home of the Blue Devils, identifying an easy-to-spot prohibited item such as a water bottle may hinder the discovery of other harder-to-spot items in the same scan. Missing items in a complex visual search is not a new idea. In the medical field, it's been known since the 1960s that radiologists tend to miss a second abnormality in an X-ray if they've already found one. The concept is dubbed satisfaction of search. Ah. Radiologists would find the first target, think they're finished, and then move on to the next patient's X-ray. Because, babe, time is whatever this thing is. Does the principle apply to non-medical areas? That's what Stephen Mitroff, an assistant professor of psychology and neuroscience at Duke, and his colleagues set out to examine shortly after the U.S. Department of Transportation banned liquids and gels. The liquids rule has introduced a whole list of easy-to-spot targets, according to Mitroff, in his new study published in the Journal of Experimental Psychology Applied. I think I renewed my subscription. Mitroff and his group asked college students to identify specific targets on a computer display, two perpendicular lines that form the letter T amid distractors such as L's and non-T's. In some cases, T's were easy to spot, in other cases more difficult because they tended to blend in with the background. They altered the frequency of easy and hard-to-spot subjects. When the two kinds of targets appeared with equal frequency, subjects apparently had no trouble finding the hard-to-spot one. When they doubled the time allowed for each search, they saw the students used barely a second of extra time, but were significantly more accurate. It didn't seem to do with time itself, but it seems to be the time pressure. When you have the impending time pressure of going quickly, you're more likely to miss a second target, says Mitrov. And a tale of airport security. You supply the music today. It's a thing. Dear Harry, from John in Hollywood. Returning Thursday after a slightly volcanic ash extended stay in London, I found Heathrow a hive of activity swarming with yellow-vested members of staff eager to direct the hordes to the teeming check-in counters. After a surprisingly efficient baggage check-in experience with American Airlines, I made my way to the security area and was pleased to exchange retaining my footwear for doffing my belt prior to walking through the scanner. I was a bit amused when the attendant tapped my breast pockets and inquired about their contents. Cash and passport, I replied. Show them, he snarled. I did, and I was nodded to pick up my irradiated carry-on items. Before I could rebelt, a female attendant asked permission to search my canvas shoulder bag. I cheerfully agreed and wondered what she would think of the two slices of pizza I had packed to serve as my meal in lieu of the American airline fare. I didn't have to wonder long, because she withdrew a 2/3 empty bottle of hot sauce I had brought from the States to amend the bland food in England. I can't let this through, she said, and I pointed out that there was less than 3 ounces of fluid in the bottle. But the bottle is 500 cc's, she said. I rolled my eyes, and she said, I know it's a silly rule, and I don't agree with it either. I moaned that one idiot has ruined for everyone, and I merely wanted to spice up my pizza. With a furtive glance behind her, she said, go ahead and put it on, and then leave the bottle. I quickly unwrapped the slices and slathered my pizza with the piquant elixir, handing her the now empty bottle with profuse thanks and a promise not to tell a soul. But while redoing my belt, I told her I would tell the Le Show audience and directed her to your website. I was moved by her compassion and hope she is still employed. Tale of airport security, ladies and gentlemen. A copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now,
he's not a general.
He commands no troops.
He's not an inspector.
He peeks at no stoops.
He's an
inspector general.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
The United States is unable to properly monitor. See if this sounds familiar. Is this getting repetitive? The United States is unable to properly monitor properly hundreds of millions of dollars in aid that we send to Western Pakistan, where Al-Qaeda and other extremists are extremely active. Well, how active do you expect extremists to be, babe? According to a new report, investigators for the General Accounting Office, the watchdog agency funded by the Congress, blame difficulties in tracking the aid on both security problems and insufficient cooperation by the Pakistani government. And they're our friends. The report focused on the problems in tracking just $750 million in aid for the so-called federally administered tribal areas, Fatah, along the Afghan border. The U.S. has pledged an additional $7.5 billion for Pakistan over the next 5 years, which would seem to make accountability important. A wide range of projects in Western Pakistan, roads and bridges and health programs and children. For women and children. It's an area of great strategic interest for the United States and Pakistan. The United States continues to face access to Pakistani government document challenges that make monitoring of projects difficult, says the report. But they're our friends, so they'll give us the act. And proposed changes to the government's foreclosure prevention initiative may impede efforts to help troubled homeowners and could lead to more fraud in the program, according to the report by the Inspector General for the Troubled Assets Program. The Making a Home Affordable Program is intended to reach as many as 4 million struggling borrowers, launched a year ago, but it has permanently modified only about 250,000 loans that prompted the Obama administration to announce changes. But the goals of these changes are ill-defined and their guidelines are unclear, which could lead to increased fraud, according to Neil Barofsky, the Inspector General for the TARP program. So, don't get foreclosed on, okay? It's good advice from the good hands people here at the show. Now, ladies and gentlemen, you know, President Obama spoke to financial honchos this week in New York. And danged if he didn't call them, and I'm quoting, titans of industry, unquote. Now, they were titans of finance, but last time I looked, industry made stuff. So you might want to call rewrite on that. And you probably know that over this weekend, the Senate Banking Committee, I believe, has released emails that it had access to as part of its investigation of Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs, of course, facing a federal civil fraud suit from the Securities and Exchange Commission. The Banking Committee released these emails, which have made the news because they show Goldman executives crowing to each other about the money they're making going short, that is to say, betting against the housing market and all the crappy securitized mortgages that grew out of the housing bubble. And it just strikes me that the news media, by hopping on these emails, is sort of missing the point. It's perfectly fine for Goldman Sachs to bet against a housing bubble if they weren't, at the same time, selling packages of securitized mortgages and not revealing to the people who bought them that they're buying them from somebody who's betting against them. That, to me, seems like, you know, it basically, when people say that Wall Street has turned into a casino, it is a grotesque insult to the casino business, because at least there, you know, the house is always betting against you.
The world was simpler, you can't forget, when Messrs. Sachs and Goldman met. Said Mr. Goldman, for years and years, our guys have got the most between the ears. Said Mr. Sachs, let's unhook the reins and find new ways to profit off our traders' brains. Clinton.
showing some cracks. Mr. Sachs to Mr. Goldman said, "We got it covered. Go back to bed."
Hank Paulson's our man, Mr. Sachs recalled. We may get a haircut, but we won't go bald. Any bailout rules will be comfy and lax. Mr. Goldman was reassured by Mr. Sachs. Bear Stearns went down, Mr. Sachs told his friend. And Lehman Brothers met a harsher end. Merrill Lynch was sold off via fax. A doer, Mr. Goldman told Mr. Sachs.
"It's time," Mr. Goldman said, "to pull some rank." "So presto," said Mr. Sachs, "we'll become a bank. We'll be covered by the payers of tax." Exulted Mr. Goldman to Mr. Sachs.
Mr. Sachs complained, "We're insured by AIG. Mr. Goldman responded, "That's fine with me. Our risky bets will be paid off in full," said Mr. Goldman, more than ever a raging bull. "Unemployment is rising," Mr. Goldman observes, "while their partnership is still thriving on nerve. Profits in the billions, ignore the attacks," says a flush Mr. Goldman to a flush Mr. Sachs. Speedy goes out of flax, Mr. Goldman and Mr. Sachs.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, listen to the warm, won't you? News of the warm, I say. Am I here today?
Soft, listen to the warm. We can listen to the warm.
New research shows that global warming and its effects, in particular ocean acidification, have descended upon shellfish reefs, particularly those formed by the Olympia oyster, which is a movement among oysters. More than one-third of the world's human-caused carbon dioxide emissions have entered the oceans, according to a biological oceanographer at UC Davis. Similar to what happens in carbonated soda, he says, increasing carbon dioxide in seawater makes it more acidic. Even with small changes in acidity, seawater becomes corrosive to the shells of aquatic organisms. That's not good news for most marine life, especially oysters. The oceanographer Brian Gaylord is investigating the consequences of this increasing ocean acidity on the growth of juvenile Olympia oysters native to the U.S. West Coast. Such early life stages can be extremely sensitive to environmental stresses like ocean acidification, he says. Well, it's the formative weeks for oysters. And another report indicates that ocean acidification is proceeding at an alarmingly rapid pace. So oysters grow up fast because your juvenile period is under stress. And yes, that shell does make you look thin. News of the warm, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
¶¶
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, on the mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archived whenever you want at harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. On your smartphone through Stitcher.com. Available as a free download to members at audible.com/LeShow and available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And it'd be just like this being Ray Nagin's last week in office if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you? Alrighty, thank you very much. Email address for this broadcast and the music played here on always available to you at harryshearer.com. Tip of the show, chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago in exile and Hawaii desks. Thanks as always to Pam Halstead and to Jenny Lawson here at WWNO FM New Orleans for helping to make today's show possible. And the show is on Twitter at LeTwits. Man, it's a shadow government. Okay, Ray, thank you. Nice that he dropped by. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. Ray, you're not homeless.
No, I'm going to Dallas, man.